in India, when Geshe Darge would teach, sometimes people would say, oh, I'm reciting this mantra, maybe I'm reciting it incorrectly. Oh, I did all these mantras and I did wrong. Of course, it's better if you can recite things correctly, correct pronunciation, everything. But Geshe Darge said, Yamataka knows what you know what you're saying. It's like a little child, like Jack, David and Karen's grandson, Boomer, who can, you know, he's not quite sure what he's saying sometimes. You know, if he's saying something, you try your best to understand. And of course, the omniscient Buddha knows what we're trying to say. So it's no. If you're requesting blessings and you're saying the mantra wrong, it's still okay. All right, nice to see you. We'd heard something that there might be some bad weather, but is it not here? Looks like not going to snow here or anything, is it?
No.
Okay. So let's begin just with, I'm going to lead you in just one prayer, the triple recitation of the with the refuge in bodhicitta, and then we'll continue with our breathing meditation that we began last time. Sangye churang soki chognam la jangchu badu dagni kyapsu chi dagi chunyen gipe sonam ki drola penchu sangye drupa shok. Let me pause for a second. So I said that time what, in theory, the listener should say. You modify when you're listening to teachings. Instead of saying, due to the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I achieve enlightenment, you say chunyan, which means listening to the Dharma. And the speaker is supposed to say chushe, due to the merits of, you know, explaining the Dharma. Sangye churang soki chognam la, jangshu bardu dagni kyapsu chi, dagi chunyen. Have you heard that before?
Yeah.
Gipe sonam ki, okay. Sangye churang soki chognam la, jangshu bardu dagni kyapsu chi, dagi chushe gipe sonam ki, drola penchi sangye drupa sho. Sangye churang soki chognam la jangchu badu dagni kyapsu chi dagi chushe gipe sonam ki drola penchi sangye drupa sho. Sit comfortably. Relax your body, relax your mind, and let's perform the 9-round breathing one time, very slowly. If you like to use your finger to hold one of the nostrils and so forth, you can, or if you're more familiar with that, as some of you said you've done this breathing meditation many times, you can, if you're familiar with how to do it, just imagining that you breathe out up your right nostril, or you can close your right nostril when you breathe. Imagine breathing in all of the white energy of the Buddhas, the omniscient mind, your gurus, who are emanations of the Buddha, bodhisattvas, coming in, filling up your right channel that goes from your nose up to the crown of the head, to the throat, to the heart chakra. And imagine that white light radiates and fills your body, burning up all the negative energy of that acts as a support of the delusions, on one hand, what's called the defiled winds, and also the winds that are associated with disease in your body. All of that is burned up, and then as it sort of congregates into the other channel, to left channel, then when you move your finger or you imagine breathing out, that white light then that's still in the right channel forces out the remnants of all of that, like the soot, all of the, like in the autumn when you toss leaves into a fire and they are all burned up and you just have some little carbon stuff ashes falling. Imagine all of the defiled winds fill your left channel. And as you breathe out, holding the right nostril closed, say, or imagining just breathing out the left, all that white energy forces all of those out beyond this room, beyond Raleigh, beyond North Carolina, beyond the United States, beyond the world, beyond the solar system. Maybe you're out of breath by that time. If you can go slowly, imagine so it has nothing to do with you any longer. Then, again, in that nostril, breathing the white light representing all of the blessings of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, the Gurus, the Yidams, Tara, Avalokiteshvara, filling up that nadi that radiates throughout your body, burning up all of the other defiled winds and illness. Again, the same thing happens. They become almost like soot in your body. And as you change your finger on the nostrils, imagine that all of that is expelled out your, in this case, your right nostril, the white light forcing that out beyond here, beyond the world, beyond this galaxy, beyond the universe. Then breathe in both very slowly, filling up both nadis, all of the remaining ignorance in your body, the winds that act as the support of that, the vehicle, the mount of that, and other subtle diseases in your body, all of that is burned up, that energy, and it enters into the heart chakra, right where the two side nadis meet, and that white energy forces it into your central channel where it's neutralized. So you don't, although you're breathing out, you imagine that wind goes into your central channel. Okay, make sense? Okay, let's do. You can imagine it's also burning up the energy, the support of the wandering thoughts that now plague us, you know, the distracting thoughts. All of that energy when you breathe out is being destroyed and breathed out, and your mind is left in a calm state. And then just sit and watch your consciousness. You can think one part of your mind, like a little corner of your mind, is paying attention to what else is happening in your mind. One part of your knowing, like a spy or an observer in a cafe. There may be some obvious things, some memories or plans, the appearance of your body to your mind, so actual presence right there, looming presence, irrefutable. The appearance of yourself, your self-identity as an observer. But a succession of thoughts sometimes by association, another thought coming, following on the previous one. Try to recognize if you don't pay attention to them, if you just stand as a neutral observer watching your mind, you don't get involved in the thoughts, that they begin to lose their durability. They begin to dissolve back into the consciousness, disappear. And you're left in a quiet, spacious state. Try to recognize this quiet as having the feature of being formless, not obstructing thoughts emerging from the consciousness, not obstructing their dissolving back into the consciousness or moving through it. Also, this spaciousness is not just like an empty space. It's endowed with the capacity to know, to cognize. Using the analogy of a turtle or tortoise withdrawing its head and four legs back into its shell, imagine withdrawing your attention away from the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body consciousness, into the cave of your heart chakra. Just your mental consciousness, just localized. Worries that you might have for this life, aspirations, are just transient events within this consciousness. Let them go. Don't pay attention to them. And again, if thoughts were to come, turn your attention away from the objective thoughts to the spaciousness and cognitive quality of the mind that's realizing them, as though turning your back on someone who's up in your face, you know, saying something bad to you, sputtering. Like turning your head away to look at the observer rather than the observed. If you're input from your eyes disturb you, imagine withdrawing your attention from them back to your heart. Ignore that. Or your ears. There's sounds that, if you're ultra sensitive to sounds, or to the aches in your body. If there is a sense of the outline of your body, your legs, your torso, your arms, your head, your shoulders, if there's some ache, recognize that your mental consciousness is aware of what the sense consciousness is perceiving. So it's just an appearance to the mental consciousness. You don't have to pay attention to that. Different ways that we've seen to let go of that, just as though turning your mind, your attention away from that, to the cognitive quality of the mind that's knowing that, or even where that appearance is, penetrating that to recognize that the fact that that thought is present or that image is present means that the mind at that very place is unobstructing. It allows that thought to be there. So focus on that unobstructing quality rather than the individual characteristics of the thought. First is an incredible challenge, letting go again and again and again, but there comes a time, even in one meditative session, where you get a glimpse of that quiet for some period of time. The spaciousness, the clear light, cognitive quality of the mind. The clear, unobstructing nature within which the train of your thoughts is chugging. And after some time you're left in quiet, I think this is what the Buddha refers to as the conventional clear light nature of the mind. This is an incredible resource that I have. And with a life of leisure and endowment as I have now, having met the teachings, being free of the usual kind of obstructions that we've had in many, many lifetimes, being born in the lower realms or having obstructions as a human, we can recognize the significance of this clarity of the mind. I don't need to be unhappy. I don't need to be angry or quarrelsome. I can replace all of the habit energy, negative habit energy, with positive habit energy, to respond with love and compassion and with insight, with wisdom. I can use this life to achieve one of the great goals of my own liberation from all of this suffering, what we call, what the Buddha called nirvana, or recognizing that all living beings are experiencing the same plight as I, but looking more deeply and recognizing they have all been intimately related with me numberless times. As a mother, for instance, having protected me, taught me, guarded me, given me enjoyments, taught me the alphabet, or how even how to sew, how to go to the toilet. Everything I know was bestowed by them, the seeds of that. To feel that warmth for them and to leave them behind, if I achieve my own personal liberation, would be a great shame. Think I should really feel that responsibility to bring them to the other shore, to alleviate their suffering in a fundamental way. And only a Buddha could do that. With whatever limited knowledge we have now, we might be able to teach them some worldly skills or dharmically some simple practices, but to really lead them from life to life to enlightenment, we ourselves have to become enlightened. So think for that purpose, to heal myself in order to benefit all sentient beings, I'm going to participate the rest of this weekend, this morning, this afternoon, tomorrow, listening with a fresh mind to the teachings on Mahamudra, integrating them in as much as possible, contemplating them, weighing them in my own mind, questioning if need be, and then when something, some understanding arises, holding that single pointedly, to develop a deeper kind of insight that arises from meditation. I'm going to participate in the talk this morning in order to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all mother sentient beings. And then bring your attention back to the present. So, nice to see you. Any observation or meditation? How was it? Okay. Anyone? Yeah. Any questions? So some of you were not here last night. I don't know if you had a chance to hear the little beginning talk yesterday. Oh, Robbie has a question. Robert.
Thank you. If it's appropriate, could you say a little bit more about this mirage-like post-meditative state when we've meditated accurately on emptiness? I mean, how long does it last? Do we go about our activities of daily life while we're in that state?
Right. So, in context, Robbie's referring to something I mentioned yesterday when I was talking about the advantages of meditating on the clear light nature of the mind. One of the advantages is that in the meditative state on clear light, so you know what I'm talking about, what the meditation we were trying to do, trying to see the clear light nature of the mind, there is a similarity to the meditative equipoise on emptiness in that the appearance is of a vacuity that has the quality of being unobstructing. But still, they're different things. You, with a clear light mind, you're recognizing the conventional nature of the mind, whereas meditation on emptiness, you're recognizing its ultimate nature. Also, there's a similarity in the post-meditation. Right now, we have not meditated enough on the clear light nature of the mind to notice this, but it's said that if you were to do the Mahamudra meditation just on the conventional clear light nature of the mind for a long period of time, when you arise from that, the appearances that again occur to your eyes, your ears, your touch and so forth, your taste, all of them seem more rainbow-like, insubstantial, like as a residue of the continuity of that understanding you had of the clear light nature of your mind, which is similar to what Robbie is referring to, the meditative, post-meditative experience after you've realized emptiness or had an insight, you've meditated on emptiness or say the selflessness of the person. And when you arise from that, like say, even just in a little short retreat I did, and I remember seeing Dave, I'll mention a little bit about my retreat experience, just experience, non-experience, a little bit integrated in as requested by Dave. Stiebel or Stiebel?
Stiebel.
Stiebel. Not evil. Rhymes with evil, but not evil, right? Stiebel. Okay. Just teasing. Very good question. So in the post, in the meditative equipoise on emptiness, again, there's what is appearing to the mind is of acuity, but it has been induced through a logic that's realized, say, that the self does not exist at all the way that the mind has been grasping to it. There's an appearance of an inherently existent I. That's irrefutable. But it's like a reflection or a mirage or an echo. It doesn't accord with reality. Our mind is believing there's something behind that we're grasping to. When you've realized the absolute absence of that I, all that you're perceiving is a spaciousness, a vacuity of that, the emptiness of the I. The I, the self does not appear, the aggregates do not appear, only that spaciousness. Like the meditation on the clear light nature of the mind, only thing that's appearing is this vacuity. When you arise from that meditative state that's called space-like meditation on emptiness, you arise and again you see phenomena. And say, for instance, the I now becomes more manifest. In that meditative equipoise on emptiness, the I was not appearing. This was a continuity of the recognition that it doesn't exist at all. But at that point, you're not thinking, the I does not exist, oh, this is emptiness, just a vacuity. When you arise, there is the understanding that it doesn't exist, but it's appearing. And to your mind, you think, just even in a short retreat, you get like, wow, is that amazing? That's, I know that doesn't exist, but damn it, it's still appearing. You know, it's like a mirage, like a dream. And so that is the post-meditative experience in emptiness may extend, depending on your insight, like say, for example, you just have just some little bit of confidence that the I doesn't exist in your meditative equipoise that was kind of okay. When you arise from that, it may last for a little while. When you have a deeper and deeper insight, or perhaps even eventually a direct realization of emptiness, then when you arise from that, that may extend until your next meditative session, that confidence that all of this is like an illusion, like a dream, like a mirage. So I believe the duration of that depends on the depth and intensity of your understanding of emptiness. So the bodhisattvas that have realized emptiness, or even the hearers and solitary realizers who realize emptiness, when they arise from that, things look less substantial, like a little bit in analogy to the experience in that you have when you rise from the meditation on the clear light nature of the mind. just the conventional. There's a sense of insubstantiality of things. Does that answer your question, Rami? Or at least get in that direction? Okay. Good question. Anyone else have a thought, question? Okay. Feel free if I go too quickly, you can ask it, just put your hand up if you have a question at any time. So just to reiterate, I gave a nutshell view of our strategy here in the Maha Mudra. Remember, between the two, the Tantric Maha Mudra, the Maha Mudra that's extolled in the Tantras by the, not the Tantras that the Buddha taught, the word Maha Mudra doesn't appear in there. The word Maha Mudra was apparently coined by the great Mahasiddhas who were practicing Tantra to talk about some particular method to bring about that realization of the subtlemost mind in Tantra that's unified, sealed with the experience of great bliss that is simultaneously realizing emptiness. In the Tantra Maha Mudra, that's what's called Maha Mudra. Whereas in the Sutra presentation, it's mainly talking about the object emptiness, the subjective mind that realizes that, not necessarily imbued with this great bliss, because it's the gross mind that we have now, and the technique that can bring that about. And the technique in this case is the succession of first meditating on the clear light nature of the mind, letting go of the other conceptual thoughts, focusing on that, and using, once you've identified that clear light nature of the mind, actually, in a factually concordant way. Is that, I can't remember the exact Tibetan. It sort of translates that way, factually concordant. That means not just your imagination of the mind, which might not really be how it is, but having experimented again and again and experienced that nature of the mind, having built up a mental image of that clear light nature, which is in accordance with how it actually is. Okay? You might have an imagination of someone who you've communicated over the phone, what they might look like, or what is it called, on social media or something, you know, and you have your first date or something and they look completely different. Or maybe you've already experienced that. Yeah, okay. Okay. So...
Not dating.
Yeah, right. No, of course not. But you kind of get an idea what you mean. That mental image you had of them was not necessarily factually concordant. And maybe it was the right gender, but maybe even not the right gender. But, you know, there's something right, but it wasn't really. So if you were to develop a mental image of the space-like nature of the mind, the clear-light nature of the mind, that was factually concordant, having experienced this again and again, then we take that as our object to concentrate on, to develop that faculty of mind that you've heard about for so many years called tranquil abiding, calm abiding. You know, there are 9 stages to developing fully qualified tranquil abiding. When you reach that last level, you have a mind which is separated from the ordinary mind of the desire realm. In fact, you have a mind of the first concentration of the form realm. That is, it's equivalent to having been born in the form realm and the consciousness that you'd have there. So you are separated temporarily from the delusions and the attachments and the anger of the desire realm. That's why in the Theravada tradition, sometimes people just achieving shamatha, when I say just achieve, it is an incredible achievement, but with respect to the goal of nirvana or enlightenment, that's just like a little waste. But for us, it's someone like that would seem incredibly, you know, like an incredible spiritual person, because they would not be affected by the ordinary attachments of this lifetime or irritations of this lifetime. So we try to use the clear light nature of the mind as our object of concentration, which, as I mentioned yesterday, and this is a review more or less what I said yesterday, the special feature of that, why we should take that as our object of concentration to realize emptiness, is because it has a similarity in appearance to emptiness, the experience of emptiness. And it, using that as our object of concentration, just being in that, all of the disturbing thoughts are subdued and they're easily observed. When disturbing thoughts, attachment, anger, jealousy, worry, whatever, whenever they arise in your consciousness, they're within that clear light nature and they're quite apparent, so you can let go of them more easily. So after having achieved a certain degree of concentration of the clear light nature of the mind, you don't necessarily have to reach full shamatha, but you can certainly continue to that point. Once you have a certain degree of stability on that, then you can use that like a laboratory, that clear light experience, to recognize the object of negation of personal selflessness. That's sort of like technical language. Does that make... Some of you may not know that. What is he talking about? The object of negation of personal selflessness. So when we meditate on no self, it doesn't mean that you don't exist at all. It means that you try to recognize what is appearing to your mental consciousness in its most subtle form, the sense of I. Is very difficult to recognize generally. It's said that sometimes meditators might spend in their cave 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, just recognizing the object of negation once they've meditated on the Lan Rim and done other meditations, of course. Otherwise they wouldn't be motivated to do that, to realize the emptiness of the self, to see it, how it's, you know, without... Because if you focus on it too closely, it's almost like it disappears. They say like a naughty person, naughty child or something. If you sort of notice their naughtiness, they immediately, you know, no, the hand was in the cookie jar and you look in that way and they're no longer there. So you have to look very, very carefully to see how this object is appearing to our mind as though it had an existence, say in the final analysis, an existence which was not just named. Like if I say, your name is what, Jill? Say, Jill. If you were to say to yourself, I, Jill, exist only as the appellation, the name, Jill, given to my body and mind. That's the only Jill that exists. Conventionally, there is something within the mind that thinks, no, there's a real Jill back here, man, or girl. There's something, you know, some residue, something. If you look, you can't quite determine what it is, but when you look in the final analysis, you can sometimes glimpse it, especially when it's instigated by, let's say, one of the classic thoughts is thinking that you've been falsely accused of something, remembering something when you've been falsely accused, the sense of indignation. I, what do you mean? Yeah, I. Because you're focusing out on, let's say, the other person or the accusation, but that I seems to be instigating it. The the primal cause of the evolution of all of our delusions. So that's called the object of negation. The Buddha's insight was that although that appears and our mind believes it, assents to it, grasps to it, it doesn't exist the way that our mind is believing it to be. The example that I find useful is, I told you several times, like in a big hotel with these big glass doors that reflect so clearly sometimes. If out of the corner of your eye, if I'm walking in my Dharma robe and I see what looks like another monk, and they're, oh, who's coming in? Also another monk. And I turn and I see it's just my own reflection. The reflection's still there, but at that point I realized that my projection, that there was something behind that, that there was, in the sense that there was a real other monk there, it's devoid of that. Right? Does that make sense? The example I gave of the echo, there's no dog over there that's making that barking sound, it's just the echo of this naughty dog here that's bouncing off the foothills over there. So once you've developed the concentration and the clear light nature of the mind, you use that as a laboratory, and it's more easy to recognize that object of negation, which in the ordinary practice is very, very difficult to find. So this is one of the advantages of the great advantage and strategy of the Sutra Mahamudra. So this is what we will be training and studying about. So then you having recognized the object of negation, you then apply the view of emptiness, the logical arguments that explain why that couldn't exist that way, why there's not really another monk over there. You know, I still say out of the corner of your eye, you're still kind of believing there's another monk and someone's telling you, no, there's no other monks in town, you know, so forth and so on. And then when you start to get a better and better view of it, through that experience, you realize its vacuity, the emptiness of the I. So that's the first, recognizing the clear light nature of the mind, the big step, concentrating on it to develop good concentration, another big step, then using that clear laboratory of the mind to recognize the object of negation, of personal selflessness, another staging point. Recognizing its emptiness, which is said, once you've recognized the object of negation, to recognize its emptiness, quite easy. You might think, oh, all those logics. But once you actually identify how it's appearing to the mind, the logical reasons can refute that quite easily. Then you have you have experience, you have some insight into emptiness. Not just on the intellectual level, you have an actual experience of it. Could you call that a realization, that you've realized emptiness? You could say so. You say yes, you say no. Okay.
Not a direct.
So,
a glimpse.
What were you going to say? The lady in the blue shirt. Oh, I thought you were going to. So there are different understandings of emptiness, as you apparently understand. First of all, we have a mental image of emptiness. Again, like when we were doing our meditation on the space-like quality of the mind, I said even, maybe I didn't say this morning, but yesterday, even your appearance of that clear light nature of the mind due to experience right now, factually concordant mental image, even that's not the clear light nature. That's sort of embedded within the clear light nature. It's just the mental image of it. If you let go of that, try to experience the actual clear light nature of the mind within which even your mental appearance of it is there, let go of that. A little bit like that in emptiness. Right now, even if you had that realization of the selflessness of the person, and you could call it a realization because it is factually concordant. Okay? Let's say having, through the Mahamudra, recognize the object of negation in a factually concordant way, use the logical reasons to refute that and have an experience of that, mere vacuity of that, the mere lack of that, that would be called a realization. through a mental image, a conceptual understanding of emptiness, which in and of itself can be incredibly powerful. While you have a continuity of the remembrance of that, the intellectually formed delusions, a lot of your delusions will be completely subjugated. They won't be abandoned in the same way that when you have a direct realization of emptiness, they'll never come back. Certain delusions will never come back, and as you enhance that direct realization of emptiness, later on, you begin to cease, abandon more and more of the subtle delusions until you reach, you know, the state when there are no more afflictions in your mind, no more klesha in your mind. You know the word klesha?
Yeah.
That we say the cause of suffering. Sometimes when you talk, if you heard in the presentation in the Theravada or something, they say the what's the cause of suffering? Of the Four Noble Truths. Attachment, three poisons, what else? Ignorance. That's the second noble truth, the cause of suffering. Generally in the Buddhist teachings they said there are two causes of suffering, karma and klesha. Karma means, you know, action, which leaves imprints in your mind. Klesha are the various deluded mental factors that create karma, right? The main cause of suffering, immediate cause of suffering, is our karma when it ripens. And also the immediate cause of happiness. Samsaric happiness, contaminated happiness, is from a Buddhist point of view the nature of suffering. So that falls into suffering. All the things we experience, even neutral feelings, are example of all-pervasive compounded suffering. So all contaminated experiences are of unsatisfactory nature, dukkha, suffering, not to put a fine point on it, suffering. So that's the principal immediate cause of suffering. What's the cause, if you look more deeply, what's the cause of that? Klesha, which means all of the mental factors, the negative mental factors that create negative karma, and even the virtuous mental factors. In this case, generally we talk about suffering, we talk about klesha, but even in virtuous states of mind that are still grasped by self-identification, not, you know, that where you still have self-grasping, what we call contaminated virtue, they create the cause of suffering. So, generally in the Theravada teachings, they don't go to that detail as popularized. They just go to the main, and like you were saying also, the main of the klesha. They leave off karma, and the main klesha they're talking about is, in the Theravada tradition, they say tanha. Have you heard of that? Thirst. Craving. Actually, it's a Sanskrit word, it's trisna, but when you go from Sanskrit to Pali, T-R, the vowel R, S-H-A, or T-R, S-H-N-A, it becomes tanha. You know, like I was joking the other day about, but Joan's not here today, is she? From Boston. Joan is from Boston. I noticed at lunch the other day she had a little Boston accent, so I said that Pali, the pronunciation of Pali, is like John Kennedy pronouncing Sanskrit. Paktika naha vidyad. You know, instead of saying karma, it's a kama. Paktika. Yeah. So trisna becomes tanha in Pali. So that is one of the 12 links. We didn't get a chance. We didn't have the karma the other night. The gas leak came on when we were going to talk about the 12 links. So, which link is that? Do you know, Robbie, of the 12 links?
Which one?
And I won't translate it into English. Tanha or trisna? What is that one? Maybe we don't know. Do you know?
I've actually
What is it?
The second
link is karmic formation. So it's not that one. What is it? Ignorance, karmic formation, consciousness, name and form, six faculties or six entrances, contact, feeling, craving, grasping, becoming. It's one of those three. Which one? Craving. Craving. It's the one that we translate as craving. And so in the Theravada tradition, they say that's the cause of suffering. Whereas in the Mahayana tradition, we go more deeply than that, and we say that even beyond just that could be superficial sense of craving, the fundamental cause of that is a misapprehension of the inherent nature of phenomena, ignorance. Right? The grasping to inherent nature. I think that's what you may have been referring to when you said ignorance. And I forget your name. Is it Judy?
Yeah.
No, the lady behind you.
Yeah.
You. Nancy, yes. You didn't say it. She said it. Okay. Give credit where credit is due. Okay. Thank you. Sorry. It didn't mean to. You were probably. But this was a good exercise for you because the eye was rising at the time. Why didn't he? I said it. Yeah. That was a good, you should, relish those moments when you've been abused. And at that point, and someone abuses you and you go into a little meditation and you say, thank you so much to the other person. They won't understand what you're talking about. But it gives you some insight. Wow, that I seemed so real at that time. He didn't recognize that I said that. Okay. So once you've realized this personal selflessness through this Sutra Mahamudra method, you can then turn your attention. You let go of that appearance of the eye. You have an understanding of the meaning of emptiness. You have an insight, a realization of emptiness. You can call it realization because it is, even though it's through a mental image, it is factually concordant. You've eliminated certain superimpositions of what that actually is. Then you turn your attention to the mental consciousness itself, within which you've been immersing yourself. You have that personal experience of that clear light nature, and you begin to investigate in the same way you investigated the object of negation of personal selflessness. Now you begin to investigate the object of negation of how this clear light nature of the mind is appearing. You contrast it with the experience of emptiness of the self. Was a mere vacuity, so that has a certain kind of similarity. But the clear light nature of the mind also has a similarity to the object of negation of the self, in that it seems to be there itself, like a real thing. You apply the same logical, once you've identified its sense of inherent existence, how the clear light nature of the mind seems to be inherently existing, you apply the same logical reasonings that you did to the self to bring about an understanding, conceptual understanding. Again and again, you use the reasoning. It doesn't exist that way because if it did, it wouldn't be able to exist in the way that it appears and so forth. We'll talk about these reasonings very simply later. And then... having become familiar again and again, at a certain point, you just focus on that mere negation of the object that you've been grasping to, and you have an experience of the emptiness of the mental consciousness, the emptiness of the mind.
The experience of the... The experience of the emptiness of the self, if you have that, I've been told by my teacher that you might experience a great fear of falling into nothingness. How would you deal with that?
So that fear is not when you have the experience of emptiness. It's when you're approaching that.
Right.
So before you become practiced in that, there can become, you know, the fact, you know, like you're saying to yourself, or someone were saying to yourself, Herb, you don't exist at all. And if you were to really believe that, say Geshe Sulga or someone told you, Herb, you don't exist at all the way you think. It's like, if you believe that for a second, it's like fear, like all these things that, a famous example, and maybe you're even referring to this, that when Lama Tsongkhapa was teaching about emptiness one time, he was alive teaching, and one of his prime disciples in the front row, I can't remember which one, wasn't Gelsub Jay or Kejub Jay, another one, he grabbed the collar of this shirt, this vest is called Donka, grabbed Donka, and Lama Tsongkhapa noticed that, and he said something that one of the members of the listening audience had some approach to recognizing emptiness, because he'd recognized the object of negation. Once you recognize the object of negation, there can be a fear that if that were negated, I wouldn't exist at all. But that precedes having an insight into emptiness. Once you have an insight into emptiness, and you've refuted that, and you rise from that meditative experience, you see that you still exist, but in a much more subtle form than you thought before, without the encrusted sense of an inherently existing I. It's through that iterative process, again and again, having some insight, that you develop confidence. In fact, great joy when you hear about emptiness. I mentioned the other day that when talking about introducing who are proper receptacles or vessels to hear the teachings on emptiness, it is said to be those individuals that when they hear about emptiness, their hairs stand on end, not out of fear, but like joy. And tears come to their eyes, not out of a sorrow, but to actually experience that. Maybe some imprint from previous lives, having become familiar with the benefits of emptiness, maybe meditating on it, having some small insights into it. Those are the individuals that are the prime vessels of the teachings on emptiness now, because they can make the rapid progress. Other ones, we're putting the primer coat on. Maybe for us, you know, maybe your hairs didn't stand on end when you heard, tears didn't come to your eye, but if you think about when you're doing purification and regret, you know, one of the four pointed forces of having created negative karma is the mental factor, remorse or regret. Not a sense of guilt, it's just recognizing that I, and still at this point thinking, inherently existent I created that inherently existent action with a, you know, upon that inherently existent recipient. Maybe I stole money or I killed that person or something. When you recognize emptiness, you realize all these things that we've created in the past, all of the ideas we had about ourselves and criticizing others, all of it is like having a blank slate, you know, like waking up from a nightmare and saying, wow, this is great. Oh, peace, you know. Mahasukha. So, from that point, that's the end point of the Sutra Mahamudra, realization of emptiness of the clear light nature of the mind. Then one is a proper vessel, one would say, to receive tantric initiation and practice the generation and completion stages of Tantra and practice the Tantra Mahamudra, the Mahamudra where you, as it's said in the text, penetrate the vital, certain vital points of the body, like the skillful, what was he called?
Butcher.
Is that maybe not the butcher? Is the one who kills, the butcher is the one who cuts it up, right? I'm not sure. What would we call the person who kills the cow? There must be a name in the slaughterer, yeah, kill this. Shinje, yeah, you know. Shinje She in Tibetan is Yamantaka. the slayer of the Lord of Death, right? Yamantaka. You've heard of Yamantaka, right?
Yeah.
So the slayer, the same word, you know. So if you know how to kill the Lord of Death, you can penetrate. That's the one that we're talking about in analogy to the human slaughterer, the Vajra slaughterer, Yamantaka. If you know the vital point, any of the tantras, to penetrate in the Vajra body, the various chakras and so forth, you become adept at that, then you can kill all of the discursive errors in the side channels, and you can give rise to the subtle, most clear light mind. And through that process, as you're approaching that mind, which is called the death evolution, which again we didn't get a chance to talk about in the course on death, you know, at the time of sleep and at the time of meditation, at the time of death, the senses absorb, the eye consciousness absorbs, because the winds that act as support come to the heart chakra, the consciousness, ear consciousness, supporting winds, and the consciousness that they support absorb, so you don't hear the nose, the tongue, the body consciousness. And there are various appearances as those to the mental consciousness. If you're not distracted by the usual thoughts in our mind, and you're aware, there's like first in a mirage-like vision. Have you heard? And then what comes next? Smoke-like vision, like incense wafting in the air. Then what's next?
Sparks.
Like fireflies or sparks from a fire. Then what's next? Like the light from a dying butter lamp, sort of quavering bluish-red light when the air element absorbs. And then what comes next? The white appearance, sort of like vast, the white, red, and black appearances when the subtle level of minds are absorbed. And then finally, the clear light, the subtle most consciousness can appear when all the other winds are absorbed. So at that time, what you try to do is you try to bring along a remembering consciousness of the meaning of emptiness. And each of those stages, if you were practicing Tantra, each of the stages that you try to induce or imagine at first in the generation stage and in the completion stage by penetrating the vital points of your body, you can actually cause these visions to take place. Each of those times you meditate on emptiness, so you're with the subtler and subtler minds, you're remembering the meaning of emptiness, until the clear light nature, when there's no longer the ability to analyze, just bare clear light nature, but you have a memory of the meaning of emptiness. And at that point, that remembering consciousness recognizes this as emptiness. Otherwise, it's just a conventional appearance to your mind. The Sutra Mahamudra conclusion, realizing the emptiness of the mind, leaves an imprint to be able to bring at that point to the completion stage. Okay, so that's more or less a reiteration of the nutshell I mentioned yesterday, sort of the Mahamudra, or in a melon. It was too big to be a nutshell, right? So I began reading the text, the root text, by the first Panchen Lama, Losan Chögyi Gyaltsen, also sometimes called the fourth Panchen Lama, you remember? Okay. Sometimes attributed, so. So I won't go over those words in detail, but just quickly read through them. Namo Mahamudraya, homage to Mahamudra, the all-pervasive nature of everything. And then the promise to compose. I bow with respect at the feet of the incomparable Guru, the Lord of Siddhas, who teaches the naked state of reality, the indivisible and inexpressible sphere of the Vajra mind. Having condensed the essence of the ocean of sutra and tantra advice, I shall write down the instructions of the Genden oral tradition of Mahamudra. That meant the oral tradition that Lama Tsongkhapa received from Manjushri, so the oral tradition, the Kagyu, that he received from Manjushri. He also received the long, the distant lineage that had come from Saraha and Tilopa and all the great Mahasiddhas through his Kagyu teachers, but he had a special, it was called short lineage. The other lineage was called the long lineage. The short lineage means that in that very lifetime, he had direct communication with the omniscient mind, in the aspect of Manjushri, heard those instructions. I will write down the instructions of the Genden oral tradition of Mahamudra of the supreme city of Siddha, Dharmavajra, and his followers who give sound instruction. So Dharmavajra was one of the lineage gurus in this, up until that point, whispered lineage, from Lama Tsongkhapa to his close disciples, so like just telling one person at a time this sutra method to develop the realization of the emptiness of the clear light nature of the mind. When it came to the first Panchen Lama, he decided that this was the time that this could be written down, and so he composed this text. So this text has three parts: preparation, actual practice, and conclusion. First, earnestly go for refuge and generate bodhicitta. So one can consider this, even though this sounds like just for a meditative session, one could consider this to be one of the preliminary practices. Sometimes one will recite the refuge and bodhicitta prayer 100,000 times, or just even the refuge prayer 100,000 times. But not just mere words, like we were saying yesterday, understanding what the meaning of refuge is, and also in generating bodhicitta, not just saying, due to the merits of practicing generosity and so forth, may I become Buddha for the sake of all sentient beings. That's the sense of bodhicitta. Do you remember, we talked yesterday what the causes of refuge were, fear and faith, right, or at least hope. What are the causes of bodhicitta? I mean, how do you develop bodhicitta? What's the essential points you have to penetrate if you know how to generate bodhicitta, what it actually is? I think I mentioned when I taught in Taiwan one time, I wasn't teaching, I was attending a conference there at Fokanshan, the famous monastery in, Kaohsiung, south of Taipei, I think. And there's a big Buddhist monastery there. Most of the students spoke English very well. They were dressed in sort of gray Chinese Mahayana robes. And I, at lunch, at meals, tea time, I would ask them questions. Well, what are the Four Noble Truths? No problem. They knew pat. What are the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths? Do you know? They knew. That's like that. Then I asked him, what is bodhicitta? I said, oh, bodhicitta is like the sky. You know, not really precise, you know, what is bodhicitta? So what is bodhicitta? Robbie, what is bodhicitta?
The wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings.
Yeah, so there's a famous verse. Did I go over this before? There's a famous verse in the Abhisamaya Alamkara. Semke pani shendon shir, yangdak zokpe jangshib de. Semke is a word, it sounds like generation of the mind. It's another synonym for bodhicitta in the Prajnaparamita Sutras. They don't usually use the word bodhicitta, which is a Sanskrit word. They use another word, which the Tibetans translated as semke, mind generation. It's referring to generating the mind in this way. Semke pani shendon shir, for the benefit of others, for the aim of others, yangdak zokpe jangshib de, to desire full, complete enlightenment. So it has two parts, two aspirations. One is aspiring to eliminate the suffering of sentient beings, so developing great compassion as a basis. Bodhicitta is not great compassion, but it's always accompanied with great compassion. Great compassion is not just compassion, and it's not just the Theravada sense of great compassion for all beings, for all sufferings. But great compassion in the Mahayana sense means taking the responsibility to alleviate their compassion, their suffering. What's the only way that you can do that? To achieve enlightenment. So based on analyzing, out of great compassion for sentient beings, how can I alleviate their suffering, all my mothers? I must achieve enlightenment. So once you know that, you can put effort into developing the various needed parts. You know you have to develop great compassion. To do that, you have to have heartwarming love for them. You need to have some method to develop that, such as recalling that they've all been your mother, they've all been kind, and so forth. Okay, so first preliminary is going for refuge and generating bodhicitta. Otherwise, the whole practice becomes kind of like an intellectual exercise, not with a particular goal. With this goal in mind, that I'm doing this to achieve enlightenment for the welfare of sentient beings, your practice of Mahamudra can actually bring about that result, can actually create the karma to achieve that. Otherwise, you're just creating some virtuous karma, perhaps, or maybe even neutral karma, because you're doing it just for to see if you can. Or like when I was a kid, in the comic books, there were at the end where they were trying to sell you things. Be the first on your block. Yeah. Do you remember? Some of the older people who remember that. Some of you that don't know what I'm talking about, too young, that were trying to entice the 6 or 10 year olds to send in a buck to get something, you know, some balloon or some magic glasses that you can see through the walls or something. Be the first on your block. So that's not the motivation of bodhicitta, be the first on your block to achieve enlightenment, you know. That's not going to, you won't even be able to achieve enlightenment that way, you know. So, first earnestly go for refuge and generate bodhicitta, since these are the gateway and the central pillar of the teachings, respectively. Refuge is the gateway to the Buddhist teachings, and bodhicitta is the main pillar, you might say, of the teachings, especially the Mahayana. This should not be mere words. So that can be a preliminary practice, or it has to be a preliminary of every session, as we did at the beginning. We said Sangye Chodang Sukhye Chognam La Jangchu Bharda Dang Nikheb Suchi, so forth. Because seeing the reality of the mind depends on amassing the collections and purifying negativity. So it says plural here, the collections or accumulations. Amassing the collections, amassing the accumulations. What are those? The collections. Is there a collection box here at Kadampa Center? Yes, it's amassing. So Donna's, when she's emptying that box, is that amassing the collections? That's not what's meant here. What are the collections? What is it referring to? Collection of merit. Collections, though, it says. Collections. Why is it? There's two collections, two accumulations. Judy, right?
Kim.
Oh, Kim. You're Nancy. Okay, I thought it was Judy. Kim. What are the collections? Collection of merit is one. To achieve enlightenment, you need two collections.
Wisdom.
I thought you said poison.
Wisdom. What?
I thought you said poison. You said poison.
Wisdom.
Wisdom. So, the collection of merit is the substantial cause of achieving the rupakaya, the form bodies of the Buddha, the nirmanakaya and the sambhogakaya. What's the substantial cause of achieving the dharmakaya? The collection of wisdom. And here, the principal wisdom that you collect is the wisdom of emptiness. So when it says the collections, it's referring not only to collecting merit, but collecting a collection of wisdom. But here we're not yet meditating on emptiness, so it's mainly the collection of merit that you do through creating virtuous actions, very powerful virtuous actions, some of which are reciting the names of the Buddhas, you know, like in the what's called the Confession of Downfalls, the 35 Buddha confession. You recite the names, you're actually collecting merit. So that, remember what I told you the name of that sutra, that section is called? It's called the Sutra of what? The three skandhas, or three heaps. So what are the three skandhas? There are a number, great number of ways of confessing, rejoicing, and dedicating. Those are the, that's why it's called again and again. And there, I confess this, I confess that, I confess it all in the liturgy of the prayer. And then there's a great number of ways of rejoicing, of thinking of all the virtues I created by practicing, even giving one grain of food to a being in the animal realm. All these merits. And then many ways of dedicating. I dedicate to the this, to that, to this, to that. Those are called the three heaps. So that confession prayer needs to, at the beginning of it also, there's an apprehension, a feeling of regret. And in the prayer, there's a promise not to do again in the future. So there's regret, promise not to do again in the future. What's one of the other opponent forces?
Remedy
and, well, resolve is not to do it again in the future, right?
Reliance
that comes in the beginning. So the other one is the remedy. So the remedy is the recitation of the names of the Buddhas, because they are creating virtuous karma. So what you can think, even just reciting those names in that prayer, even if you don't make prostrations, that's an accumulation of merit. And also, if you think about the meaning of the prayer that comes after the names, that's the confession that purifies negative karma. Here it says, so because seeing the reality of mind depends on amassing the collections and purifying negativity, first recite the 100-syllable mantra at least 100,000 times. So I mentioned Dave at breakfast, the Om Bhadra Sattva Hum, what is it, six or Humpe, six or seven syllables, is not considered enough. You have to say the 100-syllable mantra. Okay, so you have to memorize that, Dave. Can you do that? You can practice. One thing you can do is you yourself, you can, if you can find a proper pronunciation, someone who's pronouncing it in correct Sanskrit, because the Tibetans, you also, if you find Lama Zoba or some Lama, their pronunciation in Tibetan, if you have faith in that, that's okay. But that's not exactly how it's pronounced in Sanskrit. If you can recite it yourself or have recitation on a, and then duplicate that many times, put it on a MP3 file and play it while you're driving to work, the 100-syllable mantra, slowly so that you can recite along with it and, you know, you can remember it that way. Also, if you say it very loudly, like when the boys at the monastery said, I don't know, I'm sure the girls do the same thing in the nunneries, to memorize the text, when they're very little, they would sit in different places away from each other, and they would, because the other ones are reciting out loud too, to memorize the text, they have to shout very loud, you know. Semke Pani Shendong Chir Yang Dak Zokpe Chang Shub De, reading the text. It leaves an imprint in your mind to say very loudly. Sometimes you can go outside, if it's in your maybe not in your neighborhood, your neighbors aren't going Om Vajra Sattva Samaya Mano Palaya. Very loud. It leaves an imprint in your consciousness, not just in your ear. It might be good for the birds and the squirrels around also. Your neighbors might call the police. That's the problem. So recite the 100-syllable mantra at least 100,000 times and do as many hundreds of prostrations as you can while reciting the Confession of Downfalls. So usually the people also do 100,000 prostrations, although here it just says hundreds, as many hundreds of prostrations as you can. So one, and then from your heart make repeated requests to your root guru who is indivisible from all the Buddhas of the three times. So that's the practice of guru yoga. So in Geshe Rapton's book, when he was talking about one, he added also the suggestion to offer the mandala, which is, I remember when once I came to Lama Yeshe, many times come to Lama Yeshe, you know, sad or something, ask for some advice on how to control the mind. I can't control my mind, Lama, other monk is this. And Lama said, offer the mandala. That's the best way to control your mind. So that creation of merit in offering the whole universe without attachment and so forth. If I can find quickly, I didn't want to put magic marker in my book here. I should have put a little piece of paper or something. Yeah, here we go. So in addition to having so I'll just read a little bit here. We should not be anxious that these preliminaries are taking up all the time we had set aside for meditating on Mahamudra. You might feel that way. Oh, come on. I want to get to the real thing. You shouldn't think that way. You shouldn't perform them hastily with little interest. They must be done in a relaxed and calm manner. It is quite permissible to shorten them if we don't have much time, but under no circumstances should they be rushed. There's a difference between rushing and doing them, you know, just for a short time, right? You do it very slowly. The function of these preliminaries is twofold: to accumulate wholesome tendencies in the mind and to provide a basis of purity and calm for effectively engaging in the principal meditation. As long as we keep stirring and shaking a bucket of water, muddy water, the water will remain turbulent and agitated, and the mud or whatever is in it will be imbued in there. But if we set it down and it remains unmoved, the turbulence will slowly cease and the water will become calm and clear, so the mud will settle. So, you know the example when in the sutras mentioned when the army is, the horse on the cavalry is, the horses are running through the river, crossing the river, at that point, or maybe the pond, let's say, that's normally calm, the water becomes agitated, and the mud at the bottom becomes up, with the limpid pool of water now has become muddy, cloudy. So after the horses pass through, it's like your conceptual thoughts, you can calm down, the mud begins to settle, it's like the disturbing thoughts, and the agitation of the surface of the water calms down, and you're left in that calm and clear state. Similarly, if all the turmoil, worry, and agitation in the mind are gradually pacified and brought to rest by the preliminaries, we can achieve the necessary peace and clarity of mind to be able to continue successfully with the main meditation. So he then mentions some of these preliminary practices, especially the guru yoga. But I wanted to read to you just something he said about the mandala offering. Is this here? What is it? You know that little boy, the French comic book, what was it called? The little boy in Tibet. You know what I'm talking about? Or Belgium. What am I thinking of?
Tintin.
Is that pronounced right? Tintin? Yeah.
Oh, Tintin.
What do you think? Tintin or something like
right.
That. Tintin.
Yeah, right.
So it's translated, the American version is translated in English. Do you get the French edition, Robbie? Do you have it home?
No, I'm not into it. No.
Oh. Tintin in Tibet is the greatest one. That's all the other ones. He's in France. So his companion always says, Bala. So I was just saying, I was going to say bollocks here. I couldn't find the place. Okay. I'll look for that later. I'll mention about that. So let me just continue. So rather than stopping right now for everyone, if you need to, feel free as others are going to the bathroom. If you need, we'll just have a half an hour right before break, okay? Sorry. So if you can, if you're going to meditate at home on the Mahamudra, take that as a long-term project to realize the Mahamudra, try to collect these. Try to, as Lama Tsongkhapa heard from Manjushri, the three essential things that were needed to make realizations, besides meditation itself, purifying negative karma that we've accumulated in the past, the karmic seeds that are still in our mind, through application of the four forces, four opposing forces, but particularly Vajrasattva and the confession prayer and so forth, accumulating merit, such as prostrating. Each prostration you do creates the karma to be born as a universal emperor as many times as there are atoms under your body. Reciting the names of the Buddha. You know, many, many kinds of ways to accumulate merit. You yourself being generous, giving of your time to others, being patient. I used to dedicate every day in India when I was teaching at Tushita Delhi many, many years ago. You know, the rickshaw drivers would kind of, I felt like were ripping me off, and at some point I'd even kick the tire of the rickshaw, and I was leading it. Yeah, you know, yeah, there you go. You said 5 rupees now when we started, now you said it's 50, you know, or something like that. And I made a sort of, my offering to the Buddha was giving up one angry episode a day. You know, okay, I'll think that. Maybe you could try that also if you have some, you know, the next time the telemarketer comes. So purifying negative karma, accumulating virtue, and praying to the Guru as one with the Buddha, the omniscient mind. As I mentioned yesterday, if you just imagine your teacher as the omniscient mind, the Buddha, Dalai Lama, someone distant from you, that you've read their teachings or heard about them, you can receive very powerful blessings. But if your guru, if the teacher that you're depending upon is someone who you have direct contact with whom you can make offerings that they receive, with whom you receive oral teachings, correcting you in various ways, even if they seem elementary teachings, not the, you know, even teaching you the alphabet or something, you receive very quick blessings. So if you see that guru, that present guru, as perfect, you receive powerful and quick blessings. That's the special quality of guru devotion. There's no time, that's the subject of an entire sequence of teachings on guru devotion. Yes, Venerable.
Venerable George, can we go back to just the, you know, creating wisdom? And I just...
creating collection of wisdom.
The Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga, that you go through the 7 wisdoms and you recite...
there's some prayer in the afterwards. It's not in every edition, but the additional prayer after the... Yeah, this
is... And you say, the
mantra, yeah?
Yeah, and just even meditating on those, you know, the clear wisdom, profound wisdom.
Right.
Wisdom
of writing, all of these different things.
So, you know, that's a way, even if you don't have much wisdom, of kind of creating the causes of being able to...
Maybe that's creating the causes to accumulate wisdom. If you don't know what those wisdoms are, accumulate. Accumulating wisdom here, the main accumulation of wisdom is the wisdom of emptiness.
Right.
So that comes about... because, remember we said the subtlemost mind is what will leave this body at the time of death. Mm-hmm. That subtlemost mind has its own subtlemost mounted air, subtlemost air, wind, prana. They're inseparable from beginningless time until enlightenment. That subtlemost wind is the substantial cause that becomes the rupakaya. The subtlemost mind is the substantial cause that becomes the omniscient mind. So they become enlightened together. It's not like you first achieve dharmakaya and then rupakaya, it's simultaneous. The cooperative cause for the rupakaya, besides the subtlemost wind, is accumulation of merit. The cooperative cause to achieve the omniscient mind, besides the the substantial cause of the clear light nature, the subtle most clear light mind, is a collection of wisdom, realization of emptiness. So we may not be actually, we're just accumulating similitudes of the accumulation of wisdom now. When you have a real, maybe a factually concordant, a conceptual realization of emptiness, maybe that's also a similitude, a very close similitude of the collection of wisdom. Direct realization of emptiness is what is the collection of wisdom in a more direct way.
And then you've been quoting Geshe Rabtan, and I just would like to let people know that he didn't, there's an autobiography of Geshe Rabtan that's just an extraordinary read.
Yes, Geshe Rabtan was, that was, Venerable's referring to the Lama that composed this book, Echoes of Voidness, I mentioned yesterday. One third of it is on Mahamudra, that's a good one to get. And also, Venerable also pointed out to me, you have in your library, which I will return now, borrowed last night, this is the book, Teachings by the Dalai Lama on Mahamudra, and also some of the root text, Alex Berzin's translation of the root text, much more detail. So if you're interested, having heard this course and gotten a kind of a familiarity with the language, even some of the tough points, you know, it's just sort of approach to you, here you can go into them in more depth. I'd recommend this very highly. I think it's about $40 on it actually here it says $18.95, paperback edition. Maybe it's gone up since then, but anyway, very, very good. The Geluk Kargyu. One of you were asking what the name was. This is what it looks like. Okay. So, let me...
On Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Probably Barnes & Noble, if you haven't. So, yeah.
So, I'm very practical, and I'm wondering...
You should say, I think of myself as very practical.
I think of my merely labeled
sometimes our expectations
Kim.
Of ourselves, other people.
Right. My merely labeled Kim, who likes to be practical. Mm-hmm. And so, are you suggesting by going over these preliminary practices that we don't do any Mahamudra actual practice until we've done 100,000?
No. No, I'm not...
Prayer. To be clear.
There are tantric practices, say, in the Kargyu tradition, where you're not even given a tantric teaching until you've completed the preliminaries. Tantric teaching. Here, we're talking about the Sutra Mahamudra. So what we're doing is, in a similar way, in order to be successful, successively, over time, if you can accumulate purifying again and again the four opponent forces, especially, say, the 100,000 mantras, it might take you a couple of years or 7 years or something. Once a day, you say 21 mantras. That might be even a lot for most of you. Maybe 3 mantras, 7 mantras a night. How long would that take you to do 100,000? It would be quite some decades, right? You have to count. Okay, I won't do it right now.
A long time.
But it's possible also to collect merit, making mandala offerings, prostrations, and so forth. And the goal of that is to, every day, to successively make your Mahamudra meditation more successful. Mm-hmm. If you were to receive tantric initiations and you wanted to practice the tantric Mahamudra, mm-hmm. that's when this would be more essential to collect, you know, a great number of them before you start your retreat, let's say. But right now,
okay.
Before you start, you don't have to wait till, you know, 3 years from now to start doing
meditation. Just wanted to be clear. Thank you.
Yeah. So, after the preliminaries, and oh, yes, sorry. You've got 2 microphones, okay, and stereo. Susie and stereo.
This goes back to before, I'm sorry. Meditating on emptiness, you see, and you come out of it, and let's say you've been successful at some point, you see space. It's space-like.
No. In meditation, it's called space-like meditation.
Right. And when you come out, I think I have what you had described written down.
Right.
When you come out of clear light meditation, what does that look like?
that looks, there's a similitude there that Geshe Rapta referred to, that things look insubstantial because of your having prolonged concentration on the clear light nature of your mind, letting go of other thoughts, attachments, and so forth. When you arise, all of these appearances look more like rainbow, you know, sort of like insubstantial.
So
not the same way, not in the same way that the post-meditation after emptiness, they appear to be, it's sort of like almost, wow, it's like a dream, you know, like it's appearing, but I know it isn't there. It's like, was it, Joey's not here today, is he? Is Joey here? Like I gave Joey, example of Joey last night dressed as Santa Claus. You know, when you're no longer a kid, at first when Joey is coming down as Santa Claus as a kid, that looks like Santa Claus and it is Santa Claus. But later when you're 10 or 12, you're more mature than your brothers and sisters, that looks like Santa Claus, but that's just Joey, you know. It's like, oh, wow. And so that after emptiness, there's an understanding, a residue of that understanding of the lack of inherent existence that is still appearing to you. In the case of the Mahamudra, post-meditation on the clear light nature of the mind, the Sutra Mahamudra, it's a little bit different. It's not an understanding of emptiness, but just things look not the way, they don't look to be real the way they did before. And once that concentrative continuity, it degenerates after some time, they revert to, you know, oh, that's really important yogurt, or that's really cheesecake, I need that, you know. You know, things become more, you know, graspable and so forth.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Let me just go a little bit further. So, again, this is for those of you who were not last night, and just for those who were, just a reiteration, and we will continue, don't worry, we will finish this. There are many ways to explain Mahamudra, but they fall into two categories, Sutra and Tantra Mahamudra. Tantra Mahamudra is the Mahamudra of Saraha, Nargajuna, Naropa, and Maitripa. Also Nargajuna, besides associated with the Sutra Mahamudra, also associated with the Tantra. It is the clear light of great bliss. In it, the clear light of great bliss is produced from skillful means, such as penetrating the vital points of the Vajra body itself, like the skillful slaughterer, right? Like Yamantaka. It is the quiescence, or quintessence, of the highest yoga tantra taught in the corpus of essential works of the Mahasiddhas. So tantra was taught by the Buddha himself, but this particular techniques were codified by the Mahasiddhas in their tantric Mahamudra. The Buddha also taught how to penetrate the vital points of the Vajra body, but putting it together in this way by the Mahasiddhas in the tantric Mahamudra. Sutra Mahamudra is the way to meditate on emptiness taught explicitly in the extensive, intermediate, and condensed perfection of wisdom sutras. I asked yesterday, is the Heart Sutra condensed perfection of wisdom sutra that's referred to here? No. This, you understand. You understand Italian, right? This is not the way you do it. It's just this. When it's talking about the extensive, intermediate, and condensed perfection of wisdom sutras, it's referring to one particular discourse the Buddha gave that was remembered and recorded by various disciples in various recensions. There's 100,000 verse, 25,000 verse, 8,000 verse, called the large, intermediate, middling, and short, or small. Even 8,000 verses, to recite that takes a long time. They've all been translated into, no, the 25 and 8,000 have been translated into English by Edward Conza. You can find if you like to have and read them. Those are the texts that are usually the basis for main investigation about emptiness. And explicitly talking about emptiness, but indirectly, the way he's talking about, the Buddha said, this is empty, this is empty, like in the Heart Sutra, this is empty. Always, if you have an analysis of that, commentary of that, it's explaining the stages of the bodhisattvas and the hearers and the pratyeka Buddhist paths, the extensive deeds. So another way of dividing up wisdom and method is say profound wisdom and extensive deeds. The extensive deeds of the bodhisattvas are the deeds they do with bodhicitta, you know, the six perfections, or you say the ten perfections and all of the stages of that. So this is referring to that, you know, in very extensive understanding of wisdom. The supreme Arya, Nagarjuna, has stated that there is no path to liberation other than this. So sometimes you hear in the Theravada people say, oh, the Buddha said in the, the sutra on, not even Vipassana, you know, we saw Dhamma Nirshak in Tibetan, can't remember the Pali, when you're watching the breath, inhalation and exhalation of the, this is the one path. Even Christ said, other than me or other than I, other than me there is no light. What, you Catholics,
the Father except through me, something like that.
Yeah, he didn't say something like that. Other than me, something like that. He was more definitive, right? You know what I'm talking about. So various statements are made, and you might think, well, they all sound contradictory. The Buddha said just watching the breathing was one path, or maybe just shamatha was the one path, just vipassana was one path. At a certain point, that's the thing you've got to do. But here, in the final analysis, the supreme Arya Nagarjuna has stated that there is no path to liberation other than this. Other than this, realization of emptiness. There's no way that you can achieve liberation without realizing emptiness. Of course, there's no way you can achieve liberation without developing, you know, this or shamatha or vipassana. Those are earlier parts of the path, but they're essential also, and so the statements are not wrong, and maybe Christ's statement was not wrong either, you know. So you shouldn't think that these are in contradiction. Here I will give a commentary according to his intention, the Nagarjuna's intention, and show how to introduce the nature of mind in accordance with the statements of the lineage gurus. Okay, so now new material. Although called by many names, and then there's a sequence here of different practices that were commonly known at the time of the first Panchen Lama, or the, as we subsequently call the fourth Panchen Lama, Panchen Lama, innate union, the amulet box, the fivefold, is that three? Equal taste, the four syllables, pacifier, cutting off, that's one you know, ch. Lama Zopa has taught ch here. With the big drum and they're playing the thigh bone trumpet. What it means is cutting off the ego. You go to the charnel ground, or here you go, we don't have charnel grounds in Raleigh, I take it. You go to the cemetery at night, preferably when there's no moon, preferably when the guardsman is not there to chase you off, and you do this ritual calling upon the spirits, which you can almost feel palpably in the cemetery. You know, when someone dies, I mentioned before, their consciousness no longer has a recognition of their former life. So those things that are called ghosts are not really the continuity of the person who passed away. It said in some of the Medicine Buddha, when we purify a corpse after death, what we do, one of the things we do is we call all the spirits that had a karmic connection with us this lifetime. And sometimes kids feel like they have a guardian angel, maybe like some white spirit. Sometimes people who are completely out of control, multiple personalities, they may have negative spirits that have accompanied them from previous lives. When they die, those spirits know everything you did. Every cigarette you stole from mom's purse, or every time you engaged in the wrong sexual conduct or whatever, you know, all your secrets. And when you die, they can impersonate you. So one of the things we do to purify the corpse in order, before the cremation, so that those remains can be put in the Buddhist temple, we have to do a purification. We ask those spirits to take this torma, stop pretending to be that person, be happy, practice the Dharma, go away. You can't put the ashes into these consecrated temples without that. But ordinary cemeteries, there are these spirits may be around, so that it can be very frightening. So you call them up during this, and you say, please take my body, drink my blood, eat my bones, and you know, and at that point, the object of negation, a personal selflessness, arises very, very strongly, because there's, you know, the little rustling of the leaves over there, and you know, your hair standing on end, not out of joy but out of fear. And so at that point, because the object of negation is so clear, you can cut it off. That's the true practice. You maybe heard of that, some of you?
Yeah.
Sure. What do they call it? What do they translate it in English? They just say true?
Yeah.
C-H-O-D. Come again?
Chud.
Yeah, in English we say chud or chod. North Carolina, chud.
Yeah.
But it's the D is silent. It just shortens the O. Ch.
Sure. This is just part of the Bon tradition.
It's also Bunpo's practice Ch, and in the villages there were people called Chubas. They might not have been monks or even real practitioners, but they would do this ritual, and local people would come. It's like the people on the in the subway with the playing the. Buskers. So kind of like that. There were some, but that practice was brought to Tibet, I think, by Padamba Sangye, one of the great saints of Tibet, Buddhist saints. And it became amalgamated into the Bon tradition, which was the non-Buddhist tradition, which nowadays almost mirrors Tibet. They have their own kangyur and tengyur, and they wear the same clothes. You would think they were from the very beginning Buddhists, but it's sort of like taking on the affectations of the successful Buddhism. So although called by many names, I mentioned several of them, cutting off, which is true, great perfection, what is that? Dzogchen. You hear about, I'm going to give up going to Geshe-la's classes here at Kadampa Center, I'm going to have the real highest teaching. Dzogchen means the great completion. So it's a little bit like Mahamudra. This particularly in the Nyingma tradition, and also Bun. What is your name, this gentleman in the blue shirt?
Jeff.
Also Dzogchen. There's a Dzogchen tradition in the Bun. You shouldn't think that it's anything more superior to what we're learning now. We're learning, like the Mahamudra is considered to be the pinnacle of, you know, this ability to reach enlightenment in a very short amount of time. But anyway, there were all these other techniques. Great perfection, Dzogchen, counsel on the middle way view, sort of like pith instructions on that, and so on. There are many names. But when a yogi or yogini who is skilled in the scriptures and the logic of definitive meaning and who has experience analyzes, all converge in a single intent. So this is a very famous phrase from this text, because His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in commenting, has said sometimes the Gelugpas have criticized Dzogchen, you know, the Nyingma, is saying that this technique can't lead to this, but it was clear that the first Panchen Lama, or fourth Panchen Lama, who had, and the Dalai Lama also said that certain lamas, their statements, they may have made statements that they didn't really believe, but the first Panchen Lama was someone who, what he said is what he meant. So he meant, he wasn't just being like, oh yeah, Christianity and Buddhism are the same thing, you know, something like this, you know. All or whether they always joke about kumbaya, you know, everything's the same. This was actually the case, that Dzogchen, all of these different things come to the same intent. So there is a method in certain Dzogchen practice, a little bit different than the Mahamudra, even with the eyes open and actually just looking at the nature of the mind, which in Tibetan, the way in the Dzogchen teachings they call, I think it's just sem. They just say sem, but it has this particular meaning, just the bare nature of the mind, letting go of all of the, following all of the thoughts, can also bring the errors into the central channel. So this is what he meant, they all come to the same intent. So then, between the two approaches of seeking meditation on calm abiding on the basis of the view, that means what we talked about first, generally you establish the logic of emptiness a long time, and then on the basis of having understood emptiness, you concentrate on that, you try to have the experience of shamatha, tranquil abiding, then vipassana that analyzes it, and realize emptiness on the top of that, realization, experiential realization on the basis of the view. Whereas here, you develop the experience of samadhi, tranquil abiding first, and then on top of that, you develop the view. So between the two approaches, one, seeking meditation on calm abiding on the basis of the view is first, or two, seeking the view on the basis of meditation on calm abiding, on the clear light nature of the mind, you have some experience first. You don't have to wait till the end to have the experience. You can be inspired by this. Now, the explanation here follows the second approach. So the Sutra Mahamudra, and this is a great, tastiness of it. You can have some experience of some similitude of the emptiness experience now that can give you encouragement to continue doing that. So then it says, sitting, 9-round breathing meditation refuge in Bodhicitta, on a seat suitable for absorption. What is a seat suitable for absorption? Well, you could be sitting in a chair. That's fine. Main thing is the back is straight. If you're sitting on a cushion on the ground, have the back slightly elevated so that if you're sitting for a long time with crossed legs, that your back doesn't become achy. You might think, oh, the real yogis, they wouldn't have a cushion in the back. That's just for sissies. Actually, great meditators, all the manuals all say have a slight elevated in the back, so you can have a little cushion underneath the coccyx, near the back of your buttocks. On a seat suitable for absorption, adopting the 7 crucial elements of physical posture, what are they also called? The 7-point posture of Vairochana? Why is Vairochana mentioned there? Do you know, Ravi? Because Vairochana, of the 5 Buddha families, what are they? Vairochana, Amitabha, Akshobhya, Ratnasambhava, Amoghasiddha, they each correspond to one of the 5 purified 5 skandhas. Vairochana is the purified form of the form aggregate, the body. So his posture is the epitome of the, and each of them have slightly different hand gestures. So sitting in the Vajra Asana with the legs crossed, what we ourselves often call the full lotus. Is that what you call it? It's not called the lotus posture is the consort, let's say when seated, the consort, the female consort whose legs are around the waist of the male, that's called the Vajra. That's called the lotus posture. Maybe because the female organ is called the lotus. So the male organ is called the Vajra. So also when we say Om Mani Padme Hum, in the esoteric meaning, it can refer to that highest kind of tantric practice of consort practice. So sitting in the Vajra Asana with the hands at the waist, with the fingers touching, with the back straight. And I noticed when I was meditating, if my head starts to go up, thoughts, other kinds of conceptual thoughts start. So it's suggested that the head be slightly tilted down with the neck tucked in. At first, you know, it's artificial and feels unnatural, but that will keep your mind from wandering. I wonder if when you next time you meditate, if you notice a difference, if you just let your head dwell up, your other conceptual thoughts start. Namtok, we call it. So there are various postures. The eyes down toward the side of your nose. These are called the seven-point posture of Vairochana. Seven times we say the eight postures, the eighth one meaning the breathing meditation, which in this case is called the nine-round breathing meditation. So on a seat suitable for absorption, adopting the seven crucial elements of physical posture, cleanse the channels with the nine-round breathing. So cleanse the channels means imagine that the defiled winds of the winds that support the delusions and the conceptual minds and the winds that support disease and so forth are all expelled out. So you're left and actually has an effect like that. You're left in a calm state. At the beginning, with lucid awareness, thoroughly release all impurities, and with a pure, virtuous mind, go for refuge and generate bodhicitta. Meditate on the profound path of Guru Yoga, and after making hundreds of fervent requests and so on, dissolve the Guru into yourself. So that's where I'll stop right now. We'll have a break for lunch. So sometimes people wonder, you know, what is the special advantage of Guru Yoga? At this point, when you, having developed faith, at least, in the Guru as being an emanation of Buddha, imagine they absorb into your heart, and at that point, like Christian experience, like just like inviting Jesus into your heart, like everything is okay. I think that the Dalai Lama has praised various Christian practices for them within from a Christian philosophical point of view, from the tenets, it makes sense how to develop love for all beings. If all beings are created by God in His image, then you would feel love for them. So he said, there's a skillful method within that their philosophical view. So here, when the Guru dissolves into your heart, that's when you can feel some kind of similitude of great bliss. So we're going to do just a dedication on a yak, on the back of a yak. Whatever merits we've created this morning, may they not be dissipated in simply samsaric, contaminated happiness in future lifetimes, but in whatever way they ripen, may they always bring forth my continued spiritual development up to and including enlightenment. All along the line, whatever development I make, may it always be beneficial for others, not just for myself. And at the time of enlightenment, due to these merits, may I be able to spontaneously and effortlessly lead all sentient beings to the state of enlightenment due to these merits.